8 o'clock. You've been listening to the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup here on CKUT. As always, if you want to hear one of our stories, you can head to ckut.ca/LJI. My name is Jules Bijal. Thanks so much for listening.
What's the matter? Is everything all right? That's okay. I've got just the right thing for you. CKUT 90.3 FM.
Black, and you listen to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Prison Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show every other week on Tuesdays between 6 and 7 p.m. To get involved with Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Yes, rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means.
Do you?
It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a name. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow. And hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
Oh, the law. The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Yasmin, and I'll be your host for today. We would like to acknowledge that CKUT is located on unceded Haudenosaunee, Anishinaabeg, Abenaki, and Mohawk territories. The Ganyagahaga Nation is recognized as the custodians of the lands and waters on which we gather today. Jajaki, Montreal is historically known as a gathering place for many First Nations. Today, it is home to a diverse population of Indigenous and other peoples. We respect the continued connections with the past, present, and future in our ongoing relationships with Indigenous and other peoples within the Montreal community. On today's show, we are going to feature a few different items. One of them will take up most of the show. It's called Unionizing Prison Labor. It's an interview from Embers, and it's an interview with Jordan House and Asaf Rashid, the authors of the book Solidarity Beyond Bars, Unionizing Prison Labor. And on this interview, they discuss the background of the book, some historical and legal precedents, the pros and cons of rights-based approaches, the core strategic arguments for a prisoners' union, an exciting new initiative by prisoners in Laval in Quebec to form a union. And if you're around in Montreal, check out their upcoming book launch. At Concordia University on Friday, November 24th, there will be music from David Parker and Stefan Christoph, and the event will be, yes, on Friday, November 24th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Shift Center for Social Transformation. It's the Solidarity Beyond Bars, Unionizing Prison Labor. It's a book launch and discussion with Jordan House and Asaf Rashid, who are the authors of the book, and community members with lived experience of incarceration in so-called Canada. And if you want to buy the book, there's a 20% off all online book orders. There's a promo code of SBB20, and that's fernwoodpublishing.ca. And also ASL and childcare are provided with 48-hour notice for this additional accommodation requests. Email anticarceralgroup@riseup.net. So again, if there's any accommodation requests for the event that's going to be happening on November 24th, go ahead and email anticarceralgroup@riseup.net. Also wanted to tell you about some other interesting and exciting news about Prison Radio Show. We're going to have an upcoming episode that's going to focus on Palestinian prisoners that are, you know, imprisoned in occupation, and how occupation in general is a form of, is a carceral system. We're going to talk about that due to what's happening right now, what's going on, the genocide that's being committed in Gaza by Israel, and how there's been many, while there's many Israeli hostages that have been taken that are talked about a lot in the media, what's not talked about very often is the hundreds and hundreds of Palestinian children who are languishing in Palestinian prisons, in Israeli prisons, sorry, and as well the hundreds of Palestinians that have been rounded up since October 7th and from the West Bank and are being detained in Israeli prisons, along with hundreds and hundreds or even thousands of Palestinian women who are also imprisoned in Israeli prisons, and is also Palestinian men. There's many, many prisoners who are never, ever, they don't go on, undergo any trial. There's no charges or convictions. They're just held there. They're languishing. It's very hard for family to be in touch with them. So we're going to have some people on the show, not on this show, but we're setting up some exciting interviews. So that'll be upcoming. So I would say for our listeners who are interested in that, to look out for that. That should be coming up either in the next show in 2 weeks or the 2 weeks after that. And aside from that, I hope you all enjoy the interview with Jordan House and Asaf Rashid that we're going to be featuring on today's show. There's another, there's something else that we're also going to focus on this show, and that is there's an article that recently was published in Al Jazeera, and it was talking a lot about Muslim prisoners in the U.S. It says, it's entitled, "As a Muslim Prisoner in the U.S., I Worry I Will Be Cremated When I Die." We're going to link to that on our Twitter account at Prison Radio Show, so that article will be linked to. It's by Tariq Makbul, and this is sort of the like the little intro. It says, "I will likely die in prison, but before I do, myself and other prisoners want a process to ensure Islamic burial rights." And this essay that I'm talking about that was published in Al Jazeera and that was today, it says this essay was published in partnership with the Prison Journalism Project, which publishes independent journalism by jailed writers and other affected imprisonment. And so we'll link to that article on our Twitter at Prison Radio Show, and that'll give you more idea about what this individual, Tariq Makbul, who is currently incarcerated in the United States and is Muslim, is concerned about what the burial rights are. And that basically there's sort of cremation for, I think, everybody that's in prison there and who dies while they're incarcerated. There's another important piece before we get to our featured interview today that I wanted to mention as well, and it's a story that we've been following for quite some time, and it has to do with Solomon Fakiri, who was murdered in prison in Ontario. We've spoken with his brother Yusuf several times, and we've highlighted those pieces under the realm of talking about solitary confinement and talking about mental health in the prison system. And today is an important day. I believe the second day of the inquest. So for years and years, Yusuf Fakiri and his family had been advocating for an inquest into his brother's death in prison. And that was never approved. And it's taken many years in court cases. And now finally, there's video also. There's video footage of from the day that Solomon Fakiri was killed in prison by a whole bunch of, it was a group of prison guards. And that video footage has finally been released by the prison. It's taken many years. And so there's definitely some articles. We're going to try and get an interview with Yusuf, perhaps sometime later after some of this, after this week, because I know the inquest just started. So it started yesterday. And yeah, so it's a long-awaited inquest. It just began with a simple and avoidable fact, and it said that the inquest, that Fikiri should have not been behind bars, and this is what Yusuf has been saying all this time. That's become clear as time goes on and as more information comes to light about what happened, and that he was really waiting for a bed in a hospital, because he got taken in when he did get taken in into the carceral system, because there was an episode, like an interaction that happened with a neighbor, and then police were called and so forth and so on from there, got taken in, and there were no beds available, so he got placed in the correctional facility in Lindsay, Ontario. And that's where everything started to go wrong. And he, within a very short amount of time, he was killed. So the inquest into Fikiri's death began yesterday. It's expected to last for the next 15 days. And the jurors were warned about the details about what they would hear and witness, and that it would be disturbing. And among those details were those laid out in an agreed statement of facts, detailing Fikiri's life before his diagnosis, his multiple apprehensions under the Mental Health Act, his arrest on December 4th amid mental health crisis, in which he allegedly stabbed his neighbor, his 11 days at the jail where he was not permitted with visits with family, and his violent restraint on what would be his last day. And much of what was told to the jury reflects what was reported by CBC's Fifth Estate in 2019, when a former inmate, John Thibault, who had been housed in the cell across from Fikiri, described seeing guards violently and repeatedly strike and kick Fikiri. So over a period of 13 minutes from 3:03 to 3:16 on December 15th, 2016, the statement of facts says Fikiri was subjected to various incidents of the use of force, including two rounds of pepper spray to the face, as well as multiple physical strikes to his hands and to his body and head by officers using their legs and hands. And the statement of facts also says Fikiri was restrained face down on the floor by officers positioned on various parts of his body, covered with a spit hood, had his legs pulled up to his buttocks while handcuffed, while positioned on his stomach and handcuffed behind his back with leg irons, and his face was still covered. So the jurors also heard about the tensions among jail staff, who raised concerns about transferring Fikiri from shower to his jail cell without the assistance of a specialized unit. And they heard much more. And what I'm reading to you comes from a CBC article. So you can find it on cbc.ca. And it was from yesterday. And it's entitled "Video of Suleiman Fikiri's Final Moments Made Public for the First Time Since Jail Cell Death." And that was posted about 7 hours ago, November 20th, 2023, at 1:58 p.m. Okay, so those are the stories that we'll be continuing to follow, and we'll have more information on, and hopefully an interview with Yusuf coming up in the following weeks. I know this is a hard time for their family. My heart goes out to them. And I would say for anyone that's been following this, just continue to follow it. I'm sure there will be continued coverage about the inquest. And we will talk more about what an inquest is and what the possible outcomes could be on one of our following episodes. And the other issue that I wanted to bring to light before we go to our featured interview is about an article that was published in The Nation, and that talks, it's by Basil Faraj, who we hope to have on the show in an episode, hopefully in the future. It's about the war on Palestinian political prisoners. And it was published yesterday. And so you can find it at thenation.com. So the number of Palestinians in detentions has soared since October 7th. It's part of Israel's strategy of control that cannot be ignored. I'll read to you just the first paragraph, just so you can get a taste of what it's like. It says, "I haven't heard from my father since October 7th, when Israel intensified its violence against Palestinians, particularly in Gaza, following the Hamas attacks inside Israel. My father has been detained in Ofer prison for the past 4 years, awaiting trial, alongside an estimated 8,000 other Palestinians within both Israel and the occupied territories, a figure that has skyrocketed in the past few weeks. Over 2,000 of those people are being held without charge. All of them are locked away in prisons that human rights groups have long identified as centers of torture akin to Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. As Israel continues its war on Palestinians, one which hundreds of scholars have called potentially genocidal, attention has understandably focused on the unimaginably horrific death toll. Over 13,000 people have been killed in Gaza as of this writing, including over 5,500 children. This is in addition to over 200 Palestinians killed and 2,200 injured in the occupied West Bank. These crimes are almost beyond comprehension, but mass imprisonment, daily arrest, and torture are just as much part of Israel's assault as any airstrike. That is why it is so vital that we do not let those thousands behind bars languish invisibly. Before October 7th, Israel's settler colonial forces were holding nearly 5,200 Palestinian detainees, including 170 children, 33 female prisoners, 4 Palestinian Legislative Council members, and 1,264 administrative detainees. By November 20th, nearly a month into Israel's latest genocidal war, the number of political prisoners had risen to 7,000, including 200 child prisoners, 100 female prisoners, and 2,070 administrative detainees. Thousands of Palestinian laborers from the Gaza Strip who were working in Israel were also detained by Israeli forces following October 7th. A number of those laborers were recently returned to Gaza by Israel and reported that they faced torture, beatings, and verbal abuse in Israeli detention facilities. The number of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip held in Israeli prisons and detention centers remains unknown, nor is their condition known to lawyers and human rights organizations. This is in addition to the arrests and persecution of dozens of Palestinians living in Jerusalem and within the 1948 borders who were charged with incitement, raising the total number of Palestinians held in Israeli prisons and detention centers to an estimated 8,000 detainees. So I've been reading from the words, the important and informative words of a journalist named Basil Faraj. He's an academic with Bir Zeit University. He's also done work at an institution in Europe as well. And this article, if you want to continue reading it, you can find it at thenation.com. It was published yesterday, so November 20th, 2023. And it's the war on Palestinian political prisoners. The number of, and it talks a lot about the number of Palestinian prisoners that have gone up since October 7th and all the other things that we're not finding in mainstream media. And I want to say earlier, when I said that there's been hundreds of Palestinian child prisoners, I did a show, there was an earlier episode on Prison Radio a few years ago that I had focused on an organization called Defense Children International in Palestine, and hopefully we'll have someone back on from there again. But back when I had reported in the past, there had been about 800 child prisoners at that time. And so the number fluctuates at different times. But I would say definitely look at people like Basil Faraj. He's doing really good work, and his name is spelled Basil Faraj. And that article I was quoting from is on The Nation. There's a lot of really good information on the Instagram of Defense Children International in Palestine. They have a lot of information on their website as well as on their Instagram. And there's also a lot of other organizations like Samidun and Adela that also focus on Palestinian prisoners and their plight. And now we're going to focus. I'm going to turn it over to our featured interview that we discussed before that I mentioned is with Jordan House and Asaf Rashid. And again, they're going to be in Montreal in a few days from now. So Friday, November 24th, between 7 and 9 p.m. at the Schiff Center for Social Transformation. And if you want to look up that event, you can search Solidarity Beyond Bars. We'll link to it from our Twitter as well. Okay, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM and www.ckut.ca. Keep it locked.
Nothing ever burns down by itself. Every fire needs a little bit. itself. Every fire needs a little bit.
Welcome back to From Embers, a monthly show that covers anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice across so-called Canada. Today we're sharing an interview I did with Jordan House and Asaf Rashid, who co-authored a book that came out last year from Fernwood Publishing called Solidarity Beyond Bars, Unionizing Prison Labor. I picked up a copy at the Halifax Anarchist Book Fair this fall and really appreciated the clarity of writing in this book. From an outline of the prison labor work picture in provincial jails and federal prisons across the country, to numerous historic examples of prisoner efforts to improve their working conditions, to advancing a fairly compelling political, moral, legal, and strategic case for prisoners' unions as a vehicle for both prison struggles and the labor movement as a whole. In this interview, we discuss the background of the book, some historic and legal precedents, the pros and cons of more legal rights-based approaches, the core strategic arguments in the book, and finally, an exciting new initiative by prisoners in Laval, Quebec to form a union. If you happen to be in Montreal this month, both authors will be presenting at a book launch and discussion at Concordia University on Friday, November 24th at 7 p.m. at the Shift Center for Social Transformation, 1400 Maisonneuve Boulevard West, room LB145. For more info on that or to obtain a copy of the book, check out fernwoodpublishing.ca. My name is Jordan House. I am an assistant professor in the Department of Labor Studies at Brock University in St. Catharines, Ontario. And Asaf and I have known each other for a long time, which is, I guess, the origins of the book, but maybe I'll let Asaf introduce himself first.
Yeah, so I'm Asaf Rashid, and I'm a criminal defense, immigration, and prison lawyer in Halifax, Shubuckduck. And I also was a union organizer before I became a lawyer. I've been involved in a number of campaigns.
I did my PhD dissertation work on prison labor and resistance in Canada, looking at incidents of attempts by prisoners to unionize, go on strike, that kind of thing. And Asaf, what year was it? The book actually kind of started on a radio show or podcast. But Asaf had a radio show in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and invited me on to talk about my research. And several years later, we ended up writing this book together.
Yeah, it was 2013. I was interviewing you, I think, when you were in the really early stages of like just starting your PhD, basically. And then what happened from there is you kept working on your PhD, and I kept thinking about the subject. From that point on, I was involved in a couple of other union organizing campaigns. And then once I got into law school, I kept thinking about the subject and more of the legal angle of it. And then when I was in my graduating year in law school in 2017, I wrote a paper about the subject of federal prisoners trying to unionize and what the legal case was for that. And then the idea of that paper plus the work that Jordan was already doing on his PhD kind of morphed together into something more readable.
And I kind of wanted to acknowledge that some of our listeners don't live in Canada. So I think a lot of the, especially people who are in the prison abolition context, I think learn primarily about the U.S. prison industrial complex and sort of an analysis of how that came about through Angela Davis and other writers. And I was wondering if you could just kind of highlight some of the differences when we're discussing the Canadian federal prison and provincial jail system from the U.S. prison industrial complex model. Yeah, I mean, this could probably be its own whole conversation. But I mean, I think the first thing to say and the most striking thing is obviously the Canadian system is much, much smaller, you know, like an order of magnitude smaller. And also the... in terms of the industrial complex part of the prison industrial complex here, there are some differences. I think an important thing to note is that private prison management basically doesn't exist in Canada.
And so what we have is like a much more public carceral system. Also, I think a key difference is the way that the provincial and federal system works here, which is not really the same as how the state and federal system works in the U.S. In Canada, it's very simple. People who are sentenced to be incarcerated for 2 years or more go in the federal system. And if they have shorter sentence than that, they are in the provincial system, along with people who are on remand awaiting trial.
Yeah, and I think one of the points that you make in your book is about the profit incentive not being sort of the primary driver of prison labor within the Canadian system. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think these things could be overstated even in the U.S. case, the degree to which the prison system and prison labor in particular is shaped by private employers exploiting prison labor. That's definitely an element. But in the Canadian system, there's much less private involvement in prison labor. And really what we have is an attempt to subsidize or recuperate costs as part of the main driving force in the logic behind prison labor schemes. And then also in Canada, I guess, because partially the system is much more centralized, there is a real emphasis on at least kind of the rhetoric of rehabilitation in Canada as opposed to punishment, which is something that actually Asif might be able to talk more about.
Sure, yeah, okay. It definitely will come up again, but as far as in the Canadian system, there's this big focus on this concept of rehabilitation as being basically the reason why prisoners are in prison. Supposedly they're being corrected, which is, they call it the Correctional Service of Canada is the body that is running federal prisons. And in the provincial system, it's under some body called the Ministry of Corrections or something to do with corrections. But the word correction is always in there, which is, of course, similar to the idea of rehabilitation, this whole idea where people are being fixed. So prison labor in Canada is regarded as some form of something for the prisoner's own benefit. As part of general programming. So you're doing something educational or you are building something or you're cleaning a toilet or whatever. It's all considered rehabilitation as if you are the one being self-improved by what you're doing rather than doing something for the benefit of, let's say, I don't know, the prison. So it's a way that the prison authorities can obscure prison labor to kind of hide it in this idea that people are just being made better. But no, they're not doing anything of value to the prison system to offset our costs or anything like that. But we can get more into that later because it comes up in the area of the legal argument for prisoners being able to unionize.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And just before we get to that, I'm curious if you could kind of paint a picture of what work or labor is actually happening within Canadian jails and prisons kind of in general. What does that look like?
Yeah, absolutely. There's in the book, we talk about two main types of prison labor that exist in Canada, but also elsewhere. The first one is what we call institutional maintenance, which is like all the things that need to happen for a prison to function from one day to the next. So cooking, cleaning, trades work, repair work, clerical work, all that kind of stuff. And then there are prison industries. And in prison industries, goods and services are produced for sale. Typically in Canada through something called the state use system, which means that it's the government itself and especially the correctional service itself that buys most of those goods and services, but other government agencies might also. And so the major prison industries in Canada are agriculture, construction, manufacturing, things like furniture and metal shops and textile manufacturing. But there's also a whole bunch of services like auto repair, snow removal, commercial laundry, printing. And then, if you look at all of Canada and all of its history, prisoners have done all sorts of different kinds of work, everything from like farming fish to data entry and, operating phone lines, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. And in the provincial system, probably the most prominent item produced is in Ontario at the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario, where license plate for people in Ontario are actually made at that facility. So a product that everyone has at the back or front of the car, what have you, is produced in a prison. But nobody really knows that who's driving a car, except those who've bothered to look into it. So there are some very prominent products like that that are produced in prisons, but that's, I guess, a rare exception.
Yeah, and how is it gendered in terms of the, in a women's prison versus a men's prison? What are the differences in the way that labor is performed?
Yeah, critics have long pointed out the ways that prison labor in Canada is gendered, and also just that women have less access to what they call employment programming, which is kind of a nice way of saying prison labor. But there's reasons that people want jobs in prison, and women often have challenges finding work, which is rewarding and they can learn something from. And so, very stereotypically, we've got textile manufacturing, typically, historically women's work being concentrated in women's prisons. And things like construction and metal fabrication being in men's prisons.
And this has been heavily criticized by the Office of the Correctional Investigator year after year. It's been complained about year after year that there is gendered prison labor across Canada. It shouldn't be that way. The way that Jordan just described that women, those in women's prisons are effectively sewing underwear and things like that, while men are doing so-called men's work. And there's no reason why it should keep going that way. It's been complained about over and over again. Nothing has changed, which is one of the running storylines of prisons, of course, is that many complaints are made and nothing changes. But if prisoners unionize, this is a very winnable demand to end a gendered nature of prison work in Canada.
Yeah, and maybe if I could just say one more thing, the women textile work brings up one other issue, which is a common criticism of the way that, Asif was talking a bit earlier about how, there's this question of rehabilitation. Who does prison labor serve? Are prisoners getting some benefit out of it versus the correctional system? And I think, the textile manufacturing is a really good example and has been widely criticized of the kind of skills that people learn inside, doing textile manufacturing are not transferable to the outside in terms of hard skills or work experience, because there is no textile industry effectively in Canada anymore. And this raises a whole bunch of questions related to that, what is the point of training people in certain kinds of vocational skills if they're not going to be able to actually get jobs in that area upon release?
Lay out what CORCAN is, what CORCAN does, and kind of give a little bit of history and background to CORCAN.
Sure. CORCAN is the federal organization responsible for prison industries. And so it's the major prison industry agency in Canada. It was established in the early 1980s as part of a bigger reorganization of the Correctional Service of Canada, and it was an attempt to centralize and modernize prison industry. In the 1990s, it became something called a special operating agency, which basically meant that it was responsible to a government ministry, but had much more autonomy or wiggle room around like budgetary items. For example, trying to maximize revenue. And so that's the real, the origins of the current system, in Canada. There's also, kind of similar organizations at the provincial level. Asif mentioned license plate manufacturing in Ontario. That's, overseen by a provincial body called Trilcor, and some of the other Canadian provinces also, have small prison, industry programs.
Yeah, and when I think of CORCAN, I mean, I think of things like government furniture being produced in CORCAN factories, or hotel linens being laundered, this kind of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Furniture manufacturing is one of the best-known pieces of what happens to CORCAN. A lot of the furniture used in Correctional Service of Canada offices are made by prisoners. As far as I know, furniture may also end up in other federal government departments. That's just one area, as Jordan mentioned. There's a number of other works that happen through Corps Can. There's also the Agricultural Division, and there's metals, there's construction, but the furniture making is the one, the first one I heard about. There's also within the federal system, there's differences in the prestige of a particular job, and at least theoretically, these Corps Can jobs, the ones where prisoners are doing so-called training work that's getting them ready for the outside, are the ones that theoretically were supposed to be the jobs that prisoners get as they're getting closer to their release, which will set them up for being able to enter seamlessly into the outside world, which doesn't work at all, as Jordan alluded to, and we'll get back to that subject as well.
Yeah, I wanted also to talk about the role of the guards unions. What role do they play kind of in the carceral system, specifically as it relates to work programs and prison labor?
Yeah, so I mean, guards are a force in prisons, as people can imagine. And at least in terms of enforcing work discipline, there is a role that guards as well as other staff play. So if people have poor work performance, if people don't go to work, if prisoners decide to engage in some sort of collective action, then this can bring them into conflict with the guards. And then there's, you know, the kind of bigger issue of guards unions and the roles that guard unions play in basically supporting and maintaining the existing carceral system, trying to expand it, and also serving as a potential spoiler or stumbling block for prisoner organizing, including efforts by prisoners to organize around prison labor, like into prisoners' unions. So yeah, there's a lot to say about guards. The history of guards and their unions, I guess to put it, to try to, you know, be succinct about it, has been one of hostility towards prisoner organizing. We haven't seen much worker-to-worker solidarity in this context.
Yeah, the point about guards and the role they play in, of course, in security as well. There's parole officers. There's staff that prisoners have to interact with that write reports about prisoners, and those reports end up getting into the parole hearings that they end up having and can determine whether that prisoner is going to be released or not. So if you have a particular prisoner who was being treated very badly at their job, and they decided not to show up to work because the conditions are very bad, well, you know, that ends up becoming an issue for that prisoner in whenever they're dealing with the parole, because there will be a report saying this person didn't show up to work. And that tends to reflect badly in what's called the correctional plan, as far as you meeting the objective of being so-called rehabilitated, so that the parole board will decide that you're ready for whatever level of release you're going for, possibly full release. And so you can get a prisoner's work performance actually affecting their liberty. And that's how guards can actually play a role in interfering with prisoners, you know, as far as their long-term desires to be free.
Yeah, although I should say that guards and guard unions also, I guess, have play a different kind of role, or have a different kind of relationship with prisons and prisoners in a certain way too, which is that Canadian guard unions are known as being quite militant, and emphasizing, you know, what we call in labor studies job control, like you know, control over and in the workplace. And the strength of guard unions historically has served as inspiration for prisoners to try to form their own unions, basically saying, hey, if these guys are able to organize in this way and leverage some power, maybe we could do that too. And so that's a kind of interesting way that guards and their unions have and do interact with prisoners.
Yeah, I mean, I think of Kingston and the presence, not of maybe guards specifically, but correctional employees in general, having a pretty large presence in the local labor scene. And I know that's not the same. Kingston's a prison town, right? But building off of that, what role has the broader labor movement played historically vis-a-vis prisoner organizing around work? And how would you like to see that evolve?
Yeah, I'd say the history is mixed at best, if not much worse than that. You know, in the very early days of the Industrial Revolution and the development of penitentiaries, you had, you know, what were then, you know, working men and their organizations often organizing against the establishment of penitentiaries like the one in Kingston on the basis that they were afraid that prison labor would undercut their wages and ruin them. And this was done in a way which was not necessarily out of humanitarian conviction or much concern for the people who would be incarcerated, although I'm sure there was some element of that in some cases. But I think that kind of that logic of economic competition has been the main way that the labor movement has interfaced with prisoners and prison labor. And so most of the time that the labor movement's been involved in issues of prison labor, it is to ensure that prisoners are not getting, you know, vocational skills that will undermine wages or produce goods that will, you know, put some unionized industry out of business. But there have been, you know, some moments of solidarity in a few cases in the United States of unions being involved in kind of broad prison justice movement and around prisoner organizing efforts. And then in Canada, we get one very clear example in the 1970s of a union called the Canadian Food and Allied Workers Union, who organized a local in Ontario provincial prison of prisoner laborers.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that? It's a very unique example because future efforts were mostly quashed, but this one was a case where prisoners and non-prisoners working side by side were in the same union together. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Asif, do you want to talk?
Yeah, sure. So it was at the Guelph Correctional Center. So this was in the provincial setting. And it's exactly that. There was an abattoir operation. A private company employed both prisoners and non-prisoners to work in the shop. And there was a unionization campaign. And as part of the application for certification, it included both groups. There was an issue about whether prisoners should be included in the same bargaining unit. And in the end, they were. They were included. The labor board decided that despite there being this rehabilitative character to the work that prisoners are doing, because the company was earning a profit, that the benefit was coming to the company, that the prisoners should be included as employees, and they were. And some of the gains that were made were fantastic. I mean, there are things that probably people would think were impossible for prisoners. The prisoners achieved wage parity with the non-prisoner workers that were working beside them. They also achieved the ability to attend union meetings, which were outside the prison, of course, and the opportunity to keep their jobs upon release. And I'm sure probably no one would believe that was possible, but unionization was a game changer where it inherently put all these workers in the same bargaining unit. So there would be a huge issue with some workers being lesser than others within the same bargaining unit when they're doing the same jobs, because that's, of course, fundamentally problematic with any unionized workplace. And one of the reasons why the labor board decided that it was important to ensure the inclusion of prisoner workers within the same union was that if they didn't, then the prisoner workers could be used to scab against the other workers in the event of a labor disruption, which would have been a huge nightmare at the time. So that was one of the reasons the labor board saw as a policy reason for including all within the bargaining unit.
And you mentioned wage parity, but I don't think we've said yet what do prisoners make for their labor in the federal system? And this was at in a provincial jail. So what do they make in the provincial jail in Ontario?
So yeah, there's differences in, you know, in all the provinces and territories in the federal system. In the federal system, there is a pay scale system that tops out at $6.90 per day. But then that is subject to 30% of deductions for things like room and board and telephones, system fees and things of that nature. So wages are very low at the top end. And in the provincial system, things range from $0 uncompensated labor to minimum wage minus deductions for people working in prison industries in Quebec.
So earning wage parity with non-prisoner workers is a pretty huge deal in that Guelph example.
Absolutely, yeah. Compared to what's taking place today.
Yeah, this was prevailing wages in, you know, the meatpacking industry in the 70s, which I don't know what the, you know, what that was exactly off the top of my head, but it was, you know, what any, you know, meatpacking worker anywhere in Ontario basically would have been making.
And in many of the provincial prisons, it's pretty hard to find the exact details. It's still an open investigation that we've had about what exactly the compensation is in different provincial prisons for work that's being done. And I mean, what we were able to find out, at least for the purposes of when we were writing the book, was that in provincial prisons, a lot of prisoners only just get canteen credits. So the compensation is essentially next to nil for
it's peanut butter.
Yeah, basically.
Literally, yes. Peanut butter, yeah. Bag of chips.
Canteen credits, peanut butter.
There's another anecdote in the book about a prisoner's co-op that was run through the Native Brotherhood, I believe at Edmonton Institution or Mountain Institution. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so in the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of experimentation going on. Some were very top-down initiated and some were bottom-up. And one of the more bottom-up initiatives was this. The Native Brotherhood was an organization of Indigenous people in Canada, and it had some prison chapters in the 70s. And one of the projects, initiatives that the Native Brotherhood launched was a workers' cooperative called NELOF, Native Extraordinary Line of Furniture, which made decorative furniture. And the whole operation was run by the prisoners themselves with some outside support. And yeah, by all accounts was very successful. Everybody, including the prison administration, was very happy with this example. It made prison administrators' lives easier because they didn't have to find these people work. The organization was at least at first financially solvent, but it had to deal with all sorts of bureaucratic hurdles of trying to operate a business from inside a prison. There were some issues of inside-outside governance, and really in the end who got to make the final decisions in the organization. And then it also had to deal with the competitive realities of the emerging neoliberal capitalist order and trying to be a furniture business competing against, you know, the major players. And so it also kind of petered out sometime in the 80s, I think.
And then I think the next example I wanted to highlight, or that you highlight in the book, is the, I believe it's called the Confederation attempt to unionize that was initiated at West. And I think this has become the kind of legal precedent for federal prison unions that people are kind of up against. So can you explain what happened with that?
Sure, yeah. So basically in 2011 at the Mount Institution out in British Columbia, there was an attempt by prisoners to unionize, and just like any unionization campaign, it starts with signing up fellow workers by signing cards. And in an effort to try to sign people up on the range, that effort being stopped by the authorities, the prisoners who were leading the charge filed an unfair labor practice saying, well, you just stopped us from trying to organize because you prevented us from accessing our fellow prisoners to sign up. That's a basis for an unfair labor practice complaint. So that labor unfair labor practice complaint was made. And in 2013, at the Public Service Labor Relations Board, a case was heard on this unfair labor practice complaint. And there were a couple of major issues that were addressed by that labor board. One was the subject of whether prisoners were actually part of the public service at all. And it was decided that they were not, because they didn't exist in the public service, because they were not appointed by some special body. And the second issue was whether, even if the prisoners were included as part of the public service, so if they were appointed and existed on this list, they couldn't be included anyway, because they were not found to be employees, because they were considered to be basically mainly involved in rehabilitative activity rather than activity to the benefit of the employer. Since then, in 2015, there were a number of cases before the Supreme Court of Canada, which basically may end up helping federal prisoners be in a better position to unionize, because there was a case involving RCMP employees who were officially excluded from being considered employees under the Public Service Labor Relations Act. And that was found to be unconstitutional for those particular RCMP employees, because it was an arbitrary exclusion of them from the act. There's also gig economy workers have also had some successes, like Foodora workers who were told, you're not actually employees, you're independent contractors, but they won at the Ontario Labor Relations Board because it was decided that they, you know, despite attempts by the employer to suggest that they were independent contractors and not employees, the employer had more control over them, and the employer was benefiting so much that they were, in fact, employees. So there have been some wins not from other workers that could end up improving the situation for prisoners and workers, as well as it could be a better climate now.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if that case working its way through in 2015, if that was the case that came out of the federal work strike in 2013. I should give some background on that in terms of the pay cuts that happened on a federal level. That's when the 30% deductions were brought in by the Harper government, as well as the elimination of incentive pay for working in the core can industries. So that set off a wave of strike action, sort of open calls by prisoners to engage in work refusals, starting in Collins Bay and other institutions around Kingston, that eventually, I think through sort of like CBC news stories and contacts on the outside, spread across the country. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, you covered the basics of it. In 2013, the federal government, the conservative government at the time, instituted pay cuts, which they called room and board fees, which is very disingenuous, because the wages that were calculated in the federal wage scale at the time had already accounted for room and board fees. So basically, prisoners are paying them twice, one in the subminimum wage that they were getting, and then after these deductions went into place on the other end too, basically as a tax on their earnings. And there was a national prison strike, like you said, not particularly coordinated. It was about a month long, the month of October 2013 in most places. Some institutions went out longer than others. And you know, the strike kind of fizzled out, and energies got put into a legal challenge, which I think you're referencing, which ended up being called Guérin, which Asif could probably speak to.
Yeah, Guérin was actually very unfortunate. It was a pretty wholesale rejection of prisoners as employees. However, one thing about Guinée is it did not consider Section 2D of the Charter. So it wasn't based on a charter argument of the right, essentially, the right to freedom of association, which is, of course, where you have the location of the right to unionize under that particular right. Guerin never considered that. So it wasn't a charter decision. It was a decision about whether prisoners should be included as employees in order to have this basic minimum protection. At the very least, there wasn't a negative decision on prisoners winning the right to unionize, which is a separate issue.
Thanks so much for tuning in. You've been listening to Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT FM. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, I'd like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us, Collect, from Bordeaux Prison and Rivière des Prairies Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside. If you're just tuning in, we were listening to an interview from Embers. You can find it on Libsyn or wherever you get your podcasts. And it was an interview about the book Solidarity Beyond Bars, Unionizing Prison Labor, and the interview was with Jordan House and Asaf Rashid. Earlier, we also mentioned Bessel Faraj, who's wrote an article for The Nation talking about Palestinian prisoners. And earlier, we also mentioned the story about Salamin Fikiri, so you can look that up. The inquest into his death started yesterday. It's been a long time coming. And we also mentioned an article that was published in Al Jazeera by Tariq Maqbool called entitled "As a Muslim Prisoner in the U.S., I Worry I Will Be Cremated When I Die." And we'll revisit some of these issues on further episodes. And hopefully we'll have Bessel Faraj and some people to come in and talk to us about Palestinian prisoners and the plight of children, Palestinian children that are languishing inside Israeli prisons. You can check out our past episodes on the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show. Prison Radio Show is also a podcast. Please check out our episodes of PRS Podcast on Libsyn or anywhere you get your podcasts. Our show airs twice a month. It's on every other Tuesday at 6 o'clock. And the next Prison Radio Show will air at 6 o'clock on Tuesday, December 5th. If you have any questions about anything you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, please feel free to contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave us a message on our comment line at 438-337-8423. If you are in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. Feel free to write to us at the Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. Thank you for tuning in to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Yasmin. I've been your host for today. Please stay tuned. And please disregard the background noise. There's a lot of rain right now. So thanks a lot for tuning in. And stay tuned for the next show. Thank you.
The Prison Radio Show airs every other Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas of what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. You can call us collect from Bordeaux Prison and Vienne des Prairies Prison by calling 438-858-6116. Thank you to the folks at Fed Phone Line for gifting us this number. Again, the number is 438-858-6116. Feel free to call us from inside with news, song requests, and shoutouts. Pass the number along to family and friends on the outside, who are also welcome to call.
The R-O-X-A-N-N-E, and you are listening to CKUT.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
What's up, what's up, good people? To those of you listening wherever, whenever, whatever time it is, good morning, good evening, and good night. You are locked into another Tuesday evening with Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Soul P has been on the air since 1994. We bring you all the topics, the guests, the ups and downs, the highs and the lows of the black community here in Montreal, across Canada, and internationally. I'm your host for the evening, Kim Dominique Ferguson, and we have a beautiful evening of music and discussion lined up for you tonight. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 on your FM dial.
J'ai révisé les pages de mon histoire. Et pour citer les recoins de mon